Welcome back to Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting once again today with returning guest to the program, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey is the author of Bit by Bit, How Peer-to-Peer is Freeing the World. He is also the editor at Laissez-Faire Books and the director of digital development at the Foundation for Economic Education. Jeffrey, we were talking in a prior segment about, just started to touch on some of these peer-to-peer networks and the challenge it really poses to regulators as to how do they get their arms around it, and they really can't. Let's talk about some specific peer-to-peer networks that maybe you mentioned in your book.
Well, yeah, I think probably everybody has used things like Craigslist and eBay. Those are probably the oldest of the big peer-to-peer networks. And what those did was actually, in retrospect, kind of awesome. You know, they turned the whole world into an open bazaar put together by just individuals. So you list your stuff, you can sell your stuff to anybody, you can become an entrepreneur. You know, that kind of opportunity for selling goods and services around the world had never existed before, and it's an awesome thing to consider. It's dramatically changed the price structure, made the world much more competitive. Maybe you've experienced this from time to time. I've stumbled across something in my home that I thought was extremely valuable and thought, well, I could do without it. I'll sell it on eBay. And then you go to eBay and you'll need to discover that, you know, that there are thousands of other people who had the same idea. And instead of your toaster, your antique toaster being worth, you know, $500 like you thought, it's actually worth $5, That happens to us all the time. And it's put a lot of downward pressure on prices, which I think is a really good thing. That's what competition always does. But it's made the world sort of more efficient and more globally informed about existing scarcities and provided new opportunities for people to engage each other. So that's really exciting. But that was just the beginning. You know, we talked in the last segment about Airbnb, but it's true with things like job hunts now. I know so many people who have left their corporate jobs to become independent contractors by using, you know, the many services that are out there that provide opportunities for this sort of thing. So you just, you know, post your talents on a message board, and people have the opportunity to engage you for a temporary period of time. And people are able to basically turn themselves into their own CEOs of their own private companies, you know, through these kinds of services. This has been a godsend in a time where, because of government regulations, unemployment is very, very high. So we've been saved, essentially, by peer-to-peer technology in the job marketplace. I should also mention it's true for things like occupational licensure. You know, we used to think that you're not allowed to fix somebody's plumbing or repair their electricity or work on their things around the house or whatever unless you had a license to do it. You know, most localities regulate all these kinds of things. It's perfectly silly. But with a service like TaskRabbit, all you have to do is post the fact that you're good at fixing toilets or good at fixing sinks or you can clean somebody's carpets. And next thing you know, you've got a job, you know, so it's very beautiful. And it's not just TaskRabbit. I mean, we're seeing these things emerge, you know, in every area of life. Like if you want to take tennis lessons, now there are applications that allow you to hook up with a local tennis teacher. Or if you teach piano or ballet, or you're good at German and somebody needs a German teacher, there are applications for every one of these services out there. And it's awesome when you consider that in the past, there wasn't really any means to kind of like link together service providers and people who wanted the services on a peer-to-peer basis. I mean, you could always take an ad in the local newspaper, something like that, but it's very inefficient and ineffective. But so these information asymmetries are starting to vanish in light of all the technology, and it's coming into headlong conflict with all the ways we've tried to manage the world in the past through occupational licensure, very severe taxing, the IRS's, you know, tendency to want to codify and freeze everybody's jobs, you know, and tax it and name it and identify it. Things like, you know, you look back at some silly regulations that came out in the New Deal, where you had things like maximum work hours during the day and during the week, and mandates concerning break times and vacation times, and all this nonsense. I mean, these peer-to-peer services are just wiping all that out. You know, if you're an independent contractor, do you really care whether that the government tells you you can't work more than 40 hours a week? Of course not. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, people are ready to work however much they can be valuable to others.
You know, Jeffries, I'm
so
listening.
These old New Deal structures are just crumbling.
You know, as I'm listening to you talk, Jeffrey, and you mentioned something like occupational licensure. I don't know what the statistic is, but it seems to me that I read a statistic that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, like 1 in 20 occupations required a license, and now it's down to like 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 or something silly like that. Do you see this reversing this whole trend of having to be licensed to be an interior decorator and, you know, pick out colors? I mean, to name one that's ridiculous?
It's got to. You know, it's just absurd. You know, Dennis, just to tell you a quick story, I remember a few years ago, my town was hit by a tornado, and there were trees down all over town, and people's plumbing wasn't working, and their electricity was down, and there's a lot of fixes to do. And I remember the local government, absurdly, you know, went around and put into everybody's mailbox, all of it, so the whole town is a mess, right? And the government put into our mailboxes a sign that said, do not hire anybody but a licensed professional to do things like cut down your trees or fix your plumbing or, you know, deal with your appliances. It's extremely important. If you want to know who's licensed, then, you know, come to the city government, we'll tell you. Well, I mean, I had to laugh at a message like that. And in a case of emergency, like we face, nobody cares about that nonsense. You want the job done. You don't care if it's done by a licensed professional. You know, that's just perfectly silly. Well, that was just a foretaste of what was to come, because nowadays, with the kind of peer-to-peer technologies we face, we're ready to hire anybody to do anything. We don't care where they live, what their credentials are. Everything these days, Dennis, is more and more coming down to reputation. And the digital world is very good about allowing you to accumulate a reputation and earn one and earn the trust of strangers just because of your profile. And that's very interesting to me, that reputation and trust between individuals is a much more important sort of tradable commodity than any piece of paper or credentials or anything like that. And you find this out very quickly if you're trying to sell something on Amazon and you have a low rating as a seller, like you were late sending out the product or something like that, that's going to hurt your business. Or if you try to be a customer of Airbnb, you know, the person who's going to open up their home to you and let you stay in their house wants to know, you know, are you clean? Are you nice? Are you gracious? Do you have good manners? You know, do you pay your bills? These kinds of questions are extremely important. I faced this the other day because I newly registered at Airbnb and tried to get a space for a friend. Well, I was regarded with somewhat suspicion because I had just registered for the site. Well, so I had to go the extra length to explain myself and to convince the person who was opening up his home to me, to my friend of mine, that I was legitimate. You know, so these kind of trust-based systems that are working on entirely on a market-based, peer-to-peer basis are much, much more important these days than things like government certification and regulation. Now, I just think the implications for human liberty are extremely profound. And if we can make government systems of control and command obsolete through peer-to-peer technology, then liberty has a truly happy future.
So, Jeffrey, just in the time we have left, let's talk about some of these other peer-to-peer networks. You had mentioned in the first segment that we recorded that it's really affected transportation. Can you expand on that for the listeners?
Yeah. Well, it's been a beautiful thing. In my whole life, every major city has had a taxi cab monopoly, and nobody's been known what to do about it. You know, these are perfectly absurd and silly. You don't need a monopoly for taxis. Anybody can drive anybody everywhere, and people should be free to do that on a profitable basis. But, of course, most cities erected these taxi monopolies. Well, all these new services have come along, like Uber, and there are many others like that, that have just blasted apart these monopolies, so anybody can register to be an Uber driver. If you get approved, you get an application on your phone. You can get paid for picking up somebody and getting them to where they want to go. And anybody who's used one of these services knows exactly what I mean. They're so much better than official taxi monopolies. They're more efficient, they're cleaner, they're cheaper, you know? And that's just the beginning. There's a service that I'm considering using that just opened up the other day, and I'm sorry I don't remember the exact name of it, but it allows you to park for free at the airport, and while you're out of town, they rent your car out to somebody else. And so then when you get back in town, they deliver your car back to you with a all vacuumed and cleaned and newly detailed and washed, and you don't pay for the parking, and they even give you a kickback on the amount of on some of the money that they gain from renting out the car. So, you know, things like this are just making our lives much happier, and revolutionizing the way we think of service provision. These are incredibly brilliant, creative solutions to human problems that only markets can come up with. Governments are not good at coming up with new innovative ideas on making the world a better place. Markets are. So if we want the world, if we want progress in our time, we want the world to become ever more prosperous and flourishing, the only way is to put greater faith in people and less faith in government. And I think that's where we're headed.
Well, it is an exciting time. And Jeffrey, I've got about a minute and a half left. Give the listeners an update on your Liberty.me project.
Oh, listen, you know, Liberty.me is just going so well. Every single night we have live classes. I'm doing one tonight, a live session with Julie Borofsky in Washington, D.C. It's so much fun. It's a wonderful alternative to mainstream social media and provides publishing platforms and learning opportunities for people who love liberty all over the world. It's not necessarily about politics. It really is about taking charge of your life as a free person. That's what Liberty.me offers. And, you know, I, as you know, Dennis, I work for the Foundation for Economic Education, and we're about the same thing. We try to give ways for people to empower themselves and to live freer lives regardless of the political trends. I really think this is the way forward. Politics hasn't worked out so well for those of us who want to see the world freed, but taking individual initiative in your own life has done very, very well for us, and I'd like to see that continue. And that's pretty much all the things I do now professionally revolve around that theme, whether it's Foundation for Economic Education or Laissez-Faire Books or Liberty.me.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Always a pleasure to have him on the program. His book is Bit by Bit, How P2P is Freeing the World. I'd encourage you to check it out. It's available. There's a Kindle option as well at Amazon. I encourage you to check it out. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us today. Hope you'll come back.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks again to our special guest today, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, for joining us. You know, on this week's podcast, I'm discussing inflation and deflation. And on the first podcast this week, I asked the question, how can Greece be going through a deflationary depression and at the same time on the same planet have a country like Argentina that's experiencing 40% inflation in 2014? In fact, in the second segment of today's program, I talked about the fact that if you look at what a Volvo car cost in Argentina back in 2001, today a Samsung smartphone costs about the same amount. So just 14 years later, that's the effect that inflation has had on the economy in Argentina. The bottom line is that inflation occurs when the money supply expands, and deflation occurs when the money supply contracts. Now, when you look at what's happened in Argentina, Argentina has been adding money to the financial system because they have really been cut off from international credit markets. They can't go borrow money, so the only way they can finance their deficit spending is to print money. And when you print too much money and the money supply expands too quickly, the end result is inflation. And one of the symptoms of inflation is, of course, rising consumer prices. On the other side of the coin, Greece, which is part of the euro, can't print money. The politicians in Greece, in order to solve their deficit problem, have just two choices. They can raise taxes or they can cut spending. They have done both, but the process has been extremely painful. Youth unemployment in Greece is approaching 60%, as we talked about in the second segment of the program today. And when you take a look at economics, the GDP, or gross domestic product, of Greece has contracted significantly by about a third over the last 7 years. So basically, when you look at debt and the factor that debt has to be taken care of, governments have a couple choices. They can either print money or they can raise taxes and cut spending. And if the money supply contracts as a result of not printing money, we get deflation. If the money supply expands faster than money is removed from the system, or money is added to the system, I should say, faster than money is removed from the system, the outcome is inflation. Now, there was a report published by the McKinsey Global Institute February of 2015, just a couple months old, and the title of the report is Debt and Deleveraging. Many of you probably think that because we had a financial crisis in 2007 that was largely related to and due to debt excesses, that the situation has improved. However, the situation has not improved. I'll give you just a bit from the report. And again, if you'd like to check out this report, it's published by McKinsey & Company, titled Debt and Deleveraging. Deleveraging is an economist term meaning that debt has been purged from the system. The report starts by saying, after the 2008 financial crisis and the longest and deepest global recession since World War II, it was widely expected that the world's economies would deleverage. They would start to get rid of debt. It has not happened. Instead, debt continues to grow in nearly all countries in both absolute terms and relative to GDP, or gross domestic product. When you hear the term GDP, you could loosely interpret that as income. Well, if your debt rises faster than your income rises, which is really what this report is saying, that is an unsustainable pattern. It's an unsustainable trajectory, to use the term you hear a lot today. And at a certain point, that trajectory has to reverse. So the report concludes this creates fresh risks in some countries and limits growth prospects in many others. Since 2007, listen to this, global debt has grown by $57 trillion. The ratio of debt to gross domestic product, or debt to income, loosely translated, is up 17 percentage points. That's significant. So while the financial crisis was caused by debt excesses, the debt excess problem has actually gotten worse. Government debt, when you look at government debt has grown by $25 trillion since 2007. So roughly speaking, about 40% of this debt increase is attributable to an increase in government debt, while the rest is attributable to private sector debt. Both are important, and I'll explain why they're important as this segment progresses. Households worldwide have continued to borrow more. Now, in the four core crisis countries that were hit hard back in 2008, that would be the United States, the United Kingdom, Spain, and Ireland, households have deleveraged or gotten rid of debt some. But in many other countries, household debt-to-income ratios have continued to grow, and in some cases far exceed the peak levels in the crisis countries. The report says to safely manage high levels of household debt, more flexible mortgage contracts, clearer personal bankruptcy rules, and stricter lending standards are needed. Well, clearer bankruptcy rules simply means there has to be an easier way for people to walk away from debt. China's debt is rising rapidly. China's total debt has quadrupled, rising from $7 trillion in 2007 to $28 trillion by mid-2014. China now has debt to GDP, or debt to national income, on a percentage basis, it's higher than that of the United States. The United States has a 269% debt to GDP ratio. China's at 282%. Spain's at 401%, and Japan is at an eye-popping 517%, according to the report. Now, the report has an executive summary, and I want to give you just a paragraph from the executive summary. 7 years after the global financial crisis, global debt and leverage have continued to grow. From the second through the second quarter of 2014, global debt grew by $57 trillion, raising the global debt to GDP by 17 percentage points. So again, if your debt to income ratio rises, that can only continue for a period of time. And the bottom line is this: if there's too much debt to be paid, it simply won't all be paid. And all these countries, the United States included, have three choices to deal with the debt. They can raise taxes, cut spending, or print money. Now, depending on what choice they make, there are only two predictable outcomes. We will have deflation, maybe like we're seeing in Greece, or we'll have inflation, maybe like we're seeing in Argentina. Now, admittedly, those are extreme examples, but the debt still has to be paid. Japan has been printing for the last 20 years, and they've had a muddle-through economy, and their economy is continuing to lag. Their economy is continuing to get worse, and all they've done is added a whole bunch of debt to the country's balance sheet, the debt ratio of 517%. Now, in a deflationary environment, stocks decline, historically speaking. In an inflationary environment, stocks may rise, as they have nominally in the United States here over the last 14 years, but they don't rise in real terms. So when you take a look at where interest rates are today, if the next big move in interest rates will be up, in your opinion, that's going to be bad news for bond funds. If deflation kicks in, that could be bad news for stock funds. So the one bucket approach that many folks take, which is simply taking some of your assets and putting them in stock-based investments, some of your assets putting them in bond-based investments, may fail in the future. You may need to add some asset classes that are not normally considered. That's one of the topics of discussion in our Investors Discovery Kit, which is available at no cost. We'd be glad to send you one on us. All you have to do is visit the website, investingapproach.com. Give us your name. Let us know where to mail your Investor's Discovery Kit, and we will mail it to you as a free educational resource. We don't share your information. We are totally about educating folks, and we would be glad to send you your free Investor's Discovery Kit. So again, the website, investingapproach.com. That's our two podcasts for the week. Hope you got something you can use. Be sure to tune in again next week. Bye.